Hello and welcome to the 2019 Fremantle Press podcast series. My name is Holden Shepherd and I am the current winner of the City of Fremantle TAG Hungerford Award. My first novel, Invisible Boys, will be out later this year. But for the next few months, I will also be your host. Today, I am so thrilled to be talking to Dr. Marcella Pullane about her new novel, Driving Into the Sun. Marcella, welcome.
Thanks, Holden.
Now, Marcella, you taught me at Edith Cowan University, and I've been the recipient of your generosity and wisdom for many years now.
That's kind of you.
And I understand we're pretty lucky to have you because you're about to head overseas.
Yeah, I am, in March.
Fantastic. And where are you off to?
Via Hong Kong, I'm going to Israel and then via Greece to the UK and Ireland and then back to Singapore. But mainly I'll be in Israel, the UK, Ireland and Singapore for research for the next story I'm thinking about.
That's very disciplined, so it's not just a drinking trip.
No, there are a couple of breaks though. Hong Kong is a bit of a break because I have family there, and Greece because we have to fly over Greece and we've never been to Greece, so I've scheduled in some annual leave.
Fantastic. So can we talk about Driving Into the Sun?
Yes, please.
This is the new novel. Yeah. I read it in about 36 hours, which is really quick for me. But
Thank
I understand
you.
It took about a decade to produce. Is that right?
Yeah, it did. It's taken 10 years, which I guess I could say quite a lot about if you wanted me to.
I do. This is your podcast.
Okay.
The floor is yours.
Well, you know, people are often surprised that it took 10 years. And to be honest, I'm surprised that it didn't take more than 10 years, really. But I've decided that I'm going to stop apologising for it taking a decade because I think it's okay. It's okay for things to take time. I work slowly. I manage a really demanding job that I love. I manage chronic illness. I do all kinds of work with young writers and mentoring and editing and work with pen and all kinds of things. So, you know, life is very full, but I'm a slow writer anyway. Mm. I snatch time between things to write, and I think that's an okay way to be a writer. You know, I think we need to resist, as writers, we need to resist the idea that there's only one way to be a writer, and that is to somehow have the kind of life where you don't have any demands and you don't have anything else that you have to do and you're kind of looked after in some way, because that's an unrealistic expectation for life, I think. And so finding other ways to do the work, even if it's while you're sitting in the car waiting for the kids in their swimming lesson, or, you know, thinking about it while you're washing the dishes or cooking the dinner, and then, you know, writing it down on the back of a recipe or something. And that's all of those things I've done. I'm here to tell you, I'm living proof that you can, if you keep doing that,
yes,
you'll end up with something.
Yeah, that resilience and that persistence to actually, yeah, I've done a little bit, but I'm further ahead today than I was yesterday.
Yeah, I'm really good at, there are lots of things I'm not good at, but one of the things I'm really good at is perseverance.
Yes.
I think that's very important for any artist, is to persevere in the face of every obstacle.
And I absolutely agree. That perseverance over 10 years, was it a challenge to keep that kind of, that drive for the end product? Like, how long was the first draft of that 10 years? Was that several years in the making itself?
I was lucky enough to be given a grant from the Australia Council for 2010-2011, in which I was able to do a lot more writing. And I decided that I wouldn't make the same mistake that I made when I wrote The Edge of the World, which was to write in a kind of unplanned way, write into the dark, not knowing what the next sentence is going to be, let alone what the next scene is going to be, and that I would plan it all out and that that would be best use of my time. So I did that. I planned out the story and started to write the scenes, and I ended up throwing away two drafts in that period because the writing was flat. And I realised then that in order to keep the energy in my style, I needed to not know, and that was a That was a charged space somehow, although it made me really anxious, not knowing at the same time. But that anxiety somehow makes the work, the words on the page, the sentences, live in a way that if I do know, is lost. So,
do you think as creators and as artists, we actually need to lean into the fear and the trauma and the anxiety or whatever's there to actually make, you know, something that's meaningful or that's something that has energy?
I think we do. I know other writers who don't. You know, I know really good, successful novelists whose work I admire who do plan out everything and they know exactly what's going to happen and who's going to say what in every scene before they start the actual sentence-to-sentence work. And they still manage to write beautifully, but I can't do it. You know, whatever works, really. If taking a risk, kind of stepping into the unknown, having a vague sense of the work, of what maybe where it begins and where it ends, but you're not really sure how you're going to get from here to there. If that's all you've got, then you have to have some kind of faith. And if I kept waiting until I know everything, it would take me a very long time. And I think I lose interest once I've answered the questions. So I need to still not know the answers to the questions as I'm writing.
Well, I'm glad you did write Into the Dark. Mm-hmm. And so Driving Into the Sun is a fantastic, gripping, powerful novel. And it's very evocative. Can we talk a little bit about some of the content and the themes of the book? So the main character is Orla. She's 11 years old. And she goes through a hell of a lot. You threw a lot of rocks at Orla. But why was it important for you to tell this story from the point of view of an 11-year-old facing these really big themes?
I settled eventually on 11 as an age for Orla because it feels like it's just on the edge of adolescence and just leaving that kind of blissful ignorance of childhood, although childhood is not always that way. But there's a period, I think, from my own experience and from my watching my own children, there's a very small moment when we start changing, when our bodies start changing, we start to mature, but we're not yet aware of it. And it can be only a matter of weeks or months, but it's this kind of grace. I wanted to write about children's inner lives and to show, to demonstrate that children have a complex and nuanced inner life that the adult world too often overlooks. Just because a child doesn't say anything doesn't mean that there isn't a lot going on. And children need to survive. They will do or not do and say or not say according to the need for them not to be abandoned, to stay safe. There is a lot of autobiographical experience in the character of Orla because my own father died when I was a child. And I always knew from the time I was in my mid-teens that I was going to write this story, which is a long time ago now. I just had to find, a way into it. And we could talk about that later, but there was a particular novel that gave me the idea.
What was that novel?
That was Black Water by Joyce Carol Oates, which is one of my favourite novels.
Right.
In which she uses the structural technique of repeating the precipitating event. And I read this novel many years ago, loved it. And when I was thinking about how to structure this, I decided that I would have a look again at Blackwater, and I realised that she doesn't actually do it the way I remembered her doing it, but that's okay. So I'm not repeating her technique, I'm sort of using it as a launching point, I suppose. So the event of Orla's father's death, rather, haunts her. So in a way, her inability to get to come to terms with the death is also part of the rocks that are thrown at her. So I'm aware that, you know, she's not entirely a victim. She's actually in part a victim of her own shortcoming, which is her inability to accept what's happened and her inability to realise that she's not responsible.
I mean, it's fairly late in the novel when she actually says, oh, yeah, he's dead. You can see that she's kind of maybe protecting herself or trying to come up with coping mechanisms or ways of thinking, and she kind of has these flights of fancy of how she might have changed it or how it could have been different.
All of those things. And that was drawn largely from my own experience. That's what I did, and it took me a long time. It took me even longer than it takes Orla, but that would have been really boring to stretch it out for all that time. Now I realise what I was doing was necessary because I couldn't come to terms with the grief, and I wasn't sure I could survive that grief at the age I was when my father died. So I'm really, I really understand what Orla is going through, and I wanted to demonstrate that also. I think that children, as I've said before, children are grossly underestimated, and that it's really important that children are recognised as being fully human. And I know that sounds a little strange because, you know,
they're a bit alien, is that right?
Well, I've met a lot of adults who actually think children are a little bit alien, know, that they're not quite like us, that is the adult world, and that therefore that they don't or they shouldn't have the right to the same kinds of respect and kindnesses and inclusion that adults expect. And I'm concerned about that. I think children have a sense of justice and fairness and compassion and ethics, a developing ethics, and that they love and grieve and feel really deeply. And just because they don't express that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I'm baffled, you know. I'm getting old now, and I'm still baffled that this sense of children not being quite as deserving of being treated well as adults are is still in existence.
As you're saying that now, I'm thinking about how so much of the novel focuses not just on Orla, but on Deeby, who's the younger, very young sister. Is this a conversation you're wanting to tap into about how society sees children?
Yes, I really wanted to talk about how children are treated and the need for them to have respect and care and to be believed and to be listened to and to be included and drawn into to decisions that affect them. And I understand in the case of this story and the case of my own experience, a sudden death no one is prepared for, and adults find they can barely put one foot in front of the other. So the idea that they could, you know, give children the kind of emotional support that is required, you know, is a big ask. But I think while we might be getting better at that, I think there is still a long way to go.
There is so much that could be drawn from some of these themes. I'd love to talk about not just the themes, but how you have evoked them through the novel, because your writing is incredibly rich. Obviously, you have a background as a poet, as well as a writer of prose and an essayist. I mean, I'd love to ask you just in general about your use of language and structure. Mm. But in particular, something I noticed in this novel was the use of, I guess, what I would call ellipsis, where so many sentences are cut off, or there's words missing, or there's thoughts that are incomplete. You know, was this to evoke what you're talking about, that feeling of childish, not quite knowing? Or I wondered, is it just you are a poet and you know how to chop words off that are not required, and are you just going, look, I can't be bothered finishing that sentence with the next word?
No.
Because it's more powerful this way, so I'm just going to chop that word off there.
The former, not so much the latter. I'm not afraid to do it, though, and I really like compression and distillation. Wordiness doesn't interest me as a reader. I prefer to work harder with a text that is compressed a bit or already pared down, like Cormac McCarthy, for example, does in The Road, which is also one of my favourite novels. That's the field I'm working from. But the reason that I do it in this book is to get the sense of urgency or brokenness or uncertainty. And those are three quite different states, and they all exist within the novel at different times. So as Orla's fear rises, for example, in one scene when she's trying to walk with her father and he is walking on ahead and she can't catch him, the language starts to break down as a recognition that is not yet verbal starts to rise up in her about his disconnection from her, because she feels such a deep connection and yearning for his company. So I wanted a way to... I didn't want to have to say that directly. I wanted the language to do some other work aside from its direct meaning. And one way to do that is to mess around with the syntax.
Yes. I felt like I could hear all the speaking. One other thematic thing I wanted to dive into was this lack of protection for all the characters. So once the father is gone, and I think it's mentioned somewhere that, you know, you're taking away the man's place at the table, and that once it's a man-sized hole, actually, that's no one can really comprehend what to do. And you have scenes like Henry, who's Orla's mother, going to the bank and being confronted with, well, this is what it's like when you're a woman with kids and you're a widow in the late 1960s.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, and, you know, sure. To what extent does this is this still real today?
I worry about this, and that's why I included that scene because I wanted to flag that this is what is within living memory. I say I'm old, but I'm not that old, right? So this was what it was like when I was a kid. Women, if they worked for government, couldn't continue working once they were married. If they were widowed, my mother was confronted, for example, with being told that they couldn't employ her in the postal service because she was a widow. So it was this incredible position where there was a great deal of work that was done in the 70s and the second wave of feminism, but I'm concerned about where we're going, you know, the backlash against feminism and so on. And I just wanted to say, look, this is how it was. Do you really want to go back there? So easy to lose rights that have been so hard won. And we need to remember that, you know, the world was not always, it wasn't always so that women could go to school, let alone go to university, that married women could work and so on, that women could get bank loans. That wasn't always so. We can't take those things for granted.
You know, my generation, people reading this book now, won't have lived in that time. And so I think it is timely to actually capture that and say this is how it was, and as you said, do we really want to go back there?
Yeah, I mean, I teach a lot of young people, and I have for a long time, and in recent years I've become alarmed on occasion by the attitudes towards feminism, for example. It's become so difficult to declare oneself a feminist because one never knows what kind of reaction one's going to get. It's quite a provocative thing to do in a classroom, which is to me quite shocking. Do we want to go back to racism and homophobia and misogyny? I mean, we've still got so much work to do. Let's not take for granted the advantages that our predecessors have fought for.
Do you find that reaction you're talking about, has that become worse in the last few years, or say compared to 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Oh, certainly worse than it was 20 years ago.
Right.
About 10 years ago, I noticed that I was getting pushback suddenly in the classroom when I mentioned things about feminism. And as I say, that was a surprise. We recognised socially that there was a backlash, and perhaps continues to be, against feminism, although I think maybe we're living in a moment with Trump and the Me Too movement where the scales have fallen from our eyes again, and we can see what kind of world we have fought to move away from, and that it can easily be undone.
Those rights can actually be eroded again, and we can go right back. It is actually quite terrifying. Since you mentioned the classroom, can I ask about perhaps not necessarily advice, well, no, maybe advice for young writers? Because, I mean, you would teach so many writers across Perth. You taught me. You supervised my honours thesis, in fact, so thank you.
It was a pleasure.
but you have, you give a lot of advice and guidance to a lot of up-and-coming writers. You would also see a lot of new writers maybe doing a creative writing class for the first time and dabbling. I'm curious as to, you know, what do you see often that's maybe not done well, or that, you know, like a common mistake that writers are making when they're brand new, something that you would advise them to do or to not do?
Gosh, how long have you got? I've got a lot to say about this.
Please go ahead.
Okay.
I'll be taking notes as well.
Oh, I don't need to tell you. For a start, if you're going to be a writer, you have to read. Mm-hmm. I don't understand this resistance to reading by people who say they want to be writers or they are writing. And read widely, but selectively. It's like, for me, it's like you're training yourself to be really good at something, like an elite athlete would train themselves. An elite athlete has a training regime that is very selective, and so you need to be careful about what you read, what you're spending your time reading. That's my opinion. So choose well, because what also happens is that when we're emerging writers, but not only emerging writers, the material we're reading gives us ideas about what is possible. And if the ideas we're getting about what is possible are pretty ordinary ideas, then, you know, it's not nurturing or stretching us in our artistic endeavours. So what we want is, we want a masterclass, yeah? Every time we read something, we want a masterclass that's going to make us go, wow, okay, I'd never thought about doing that, or I wonder if I could try that, or I'll never be able to do that. I might as well give up now. And then, you know, you kind of feel sad about it for 2 days and then you're back. You go, oh, well, I'll just do what I can do. But that's something to aspire to. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. And the other thing is, as I said earlier, is perseverance. Just to keep going, to keep doing it, despite everything that will happen. And there'll be many things, as you know, that happen. And we live in a culture that is not going to support us in our artistic endeavour, because, you know, we should be making money, we should be doing something useful. There are cultures in the world, and I've visited them, and it's quite a shock when you're there as a writer to be in a culture where thousands of people will come out for a poetry reading, not 20.
What must that be like?
What must that be like? Yeah.
That sounds like heaven. Can we go there, please?
Yeah. They're all through the Middle East. They're, you know, they're in South America. They're in Europe, in Ireland. So we don't live there, right? And there are other things. There are other things that are good about where we live in here.
Absolutely.
One of them is the flip side of that, which is that we're left alone. And I think that's really important too, for writers to be left in peace, to actually do the writing. So we've got to persevere despite everything, despite needing to work, despite having to manage relationships and all the other things that we have to do. And be selective about who you show your work to. Recognise that the people who love you are not necessarily the people whose opinions you need to take. It's good for them to read your work and to tell you how fantastic you are. But we also need to recognise that they're not perhaps in the best position to be dispassionate, informed critics.
So is it about finding a critical eye who can give you critical feedback without also kind of crushing your soul? Because,
yes.
I mean, I've done that before, where I've gone, this person's going to be great to send my writing to, and you do, and they kind of destroy you. And that can be really damaging as well, maybe as damaging as being told you're amazing.
I agree. It's one has to be really careful and still persevere. I was once told something I wrote was not a story. And I still remember, like, 40 years later, by a writer who I really admired. And I didn't write for quite a long time after that. But there has to be something in you, I think. I didn't really choose it. I just have to do it. I fell in love with words. I can still remember the moment I first read a sentence when I was 5.
Right.
And it was like the light went on in the world. I think that if you have that love for language and for storytelling, then you kind of have to do it to survive.
I totally agree. I think with writers, it's kind of in the blood. I need to jump into another question because you have set me up perfectly for like the best segue in the world. Good. I had a question about words, and it's actually from Driving Into the Sun. So Orla mentions something about words could rescue her. So she says, sometimes walking to and from school, she would try out sentences that could make it sound all right. Sentences that would start well but then fail. When all the words she thought she knew, words that could rescue her, change it from what it was into what she wanted it to be, just vanished. To what extent do words rescue you, Marcella Pullen?
It's true to say that I can't imagine continuing living without reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also true to say that with this book, that's what I was trying to do, I think. The little girl in me who is still trying, who I'm still carrying around, the one whose father died, is trying to find a way to tell a story about what that's like that makes it all right. But that's not possible. You know, words don't make things all right. They soothe us and they inspire us and they give us places and things to imagine and aspire to, and they put us in other people's bodies and in their worlds. But in the end, they don't necessarily make things all right. But soothing is enough, you know. Inspiration is enough. Imagination is enough. Hope is enough, I think.
And I think that's what your words do in this book. I think your words will soothe, inspire, generate hope, generate thoughts and generate reflection for a lot of people, for sure. It's a really, really evocative title, Driving Into the Sun. And I just had this image of Orla and Deeby and Henry, the mum. I had this image of them literally driving, you know, to the west, to the beaches of Perth, driving into the sun, and everything that comes with that is so evocative. I mean, they're driving, their horizon they can't see. It's unseen. There are dangers ahead that they can't see. They're blinded in a lot of ways. They're flying blind.
Mm.
What was the reason for the title choice?
Exactly that. This family has come from somewhere else. They're trying to make a home here in Perth. They don't really know this place. They don't really know anybody here. It's kind of a journey into the unknown. The place is drenched with sunlight, and it's very important as a metaphor or a motif in the story. We are on the west, and a lot of people are drawn to the beach and the wildness and beauty of that, and we're really lucky to have it. But it's hot and the sun is blinding. I remember being a kid and before, you know, tinted windows and air conditioning.
And did you lay on the tiles? We used to lay on the tiles.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of lying on cool surfaces. You know, driving somewhere, particularly to the beach, having to head west and have that afternoon sun, or, you know, going into the city and then coming back. It's literal, you know, about the place, but it's also metaphoric, as you say. It's about not knowing what's ahead, about being blinded by what you're heading towards. So you can't see anything and you just have to negotiate that. You arrive there, or continue to arrive, continually arriving, in this sense of being dazzled and not being quite orientated to the place or what's about to happen to you. And how can you be? Because things blindside us, you know. The things that we want to do are not necessarily the things that are good for us. But we can't know that, and we can't see.
Until we begin driving into the sun.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful title, a beautiful book, and I'd love to hear from that now, sure, if that's okay.
Yes.
So which section will you be reading from for our listeners today?
Well, I thought I'd read the opening scene.
Wonderful. The floor is yours.
Cold and still, the moon overhead, and the track from the sheds to the farmhouse overhung by trees. It isn't far. They're walking up ahead of him, eager now that it's all over. He can hear them joking about, shoving one another, laughing. He'd smile too if he could, because it's hard, dirty work, this work, best done at night. And that means they've all been here, the other lads and him, for the past 3 nights, and he's not been getting home till dawn, falling into bed beside Henrietta, falling into a dead sleep, woken groggy and nauseous by the kids an hour later. Snatches of sleep through the past 2 days. They were Saturday and Sunday, weren't they? While Henry's been at work herself. then a nap when she gets back, a shower, leaning against the wall, the hot water pouring on him, and off to work again. He'd smile now if he could, because the job's finished, but his legs are lead, he's short of breath, queasy, more tired than he can recall ever being. He'd smile now because it's Monday, the important day, because there were moments he wasn't sure he'd... Well, the 10 o'clock appointment is almost here, so... He'd smile because it must be nearly dawn, though he's not sure he's left his watch in his car. And the stinking job is over and he can begin to believe that he will. He will turn up in his suit beside his Henry and sign the contract. If he could just stretch out his arm, he could almost touch it. And he wants to smile. He does. This important day. From up ahead, he hears one of the lads yawn extravagantly and say, "It's nearly three," and that makes sense. And then his mid-step, his pain, his clutch, his opens, his staggers, he pitches forward, makes the ah sound of all breath leaving, his legs already gone from him, and he hits the ground hard. And he hasn't been kind to his girl, his good girl, Orla. He hasn't. He hasn't been kind to her.
Wow, that was Marcella Pelayan reading from her amazing new novel, Driving Into the Sun. Driving Into the Sun is out in February, is that right?
Yes, 1st of Feb.
Fantastic. Marcella, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Holden. It's been a pleasure.